From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For divining the state of world opinion on the war in Afghanistan, presumably there is no better tool than a survey of the world press. Editorials and news columns should be fairly good barometers of how the war is playing country by country. The problem is that lately the barometers have been jumping wildly up and down, one day suggesting placidity, the next day a gathering storm. Joining us once again is Martin Walker, Chief International Correspondent for United Press International. Martin, this week Jack Straw, the newly appointed British Foreign Secretary, criticized the press for a case of the Kosovo wobblies, that having earlier supported military action, the press now seemed to be getting nervous. Have you seen evidence of the wobblies in the British press and elsewhere in Europe?
Oh, absolutely. Over the weekend, it wasn't so much people getting wobbly, they were getting positively shaky. The Independent in London, for example, called for a pause in the bombing. On the Monday, we had the front page of Britain's Daily Mirror saying this war is a fraud, and The Guardian publishing a poll saying 54% of the people in Britain wanted a pause in the bombing to let some food supplies go in. In Switzerland, Geneva's Le Temps said it had been the worst week of the war. Over a period of a few days, the Americans were guilty of badly targeted bombings and massacring civilians without, however, managing to enable their local allies on the ground to make any significant advance. In France, Libération of Paris was saying these counterproductive bombardments threaten to smash to pieces the fragile anti-terrorist coalition. It's clear that the bombing phase, with its succession of bloody mistakes, cannot and should not continue for much longer.
Apart from kibitzing the conduct of the war to date, are these news organizations suggesting that the military action is just the wrong path and that we should rethink the entire approach to dealing with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda?
Well, from my reading of the editorials, they hadn't thought it through, at least at the beginning of the week. They were just saying, we don't like the way this war is being fought, we don't like the way the war is going, and that was pretty much all across Europe, except from Russia. I'm quoting from Pravda here. In this situation, Russia has a unique chance to have closer contact with the US, but this contact should not be of a single-handed character. The New World Order is currently being formed, and we have to secure a worthy place under the new sun.
Well, what is the press coverage in the latter part of the week reflect?
Well, it began to shift, and I think one of the factors was a very combative and tough speech by Tony Blair in Britain, in which he said, look, we've got to remember what got us into this mess, and that is the atrocity of September the 11th. And that was a tone that then began to be picked up more and more widely all around Europe, certainly in the Times, which had begun by saying there is a real fear in Downing Street, the electorate is slipping away from them, but that concern is misplaced. If there's any sense of wobble at present, it's not that voters have belatedly realised what they're being led into. The problems are rather that the military campaign appears to depend so much on air power, with an easy echoes of Kosovo, that the official messages that have emerged in the past week have not so much lowered expectations as strangled them. In Spain, El Mundo, although the progress of the war is relatively uncertain and the prospects for capturing bin Laden doubtful, the West simply has no other alternative. The battle for public opinion may even be lost, and that would be grave. But there is no choice but to continue. This was absolutely widespread across Europe. In Germany, for example, I picked up on a really very, very striking piece, again praising Tony Blair from the Frankfurter Allgemeine, which is a centre-right newspaper, saying, Tony Blair is the ideal man to hold together the crumbling coalition, not just in Europe, but in the Middle East. He is the only man putting forward the arguments that the world now needs to hear.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because it strikes me that President Bush appears periodically, if not daily, but the person who is rallying the troops, rallying the cause worldwide, seems to be Prime Minister Blair. Have you detected that? More to the point, have the press around the world detected that and started to raise their eyebrows?
Well, yes, they have a bit. Certainly there was that reference in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and the Berliner Morgenpost said that Mr. Blair is acting as the real Secretary of State. In Britain, the reaction has been rather more muted, in which they're suggesting Mr. Blair is getting perhaps a bit too big for his boots, and would he kindly pay some attention to the state of British hospitals and the British public transport?
Well, Martin Walker, once again, thank you very much for reading those papers from all over the world and sharing it with us.
I'm sorry I rustled them.
You can rustle with us Anytime. Martin Walker is the chief international correspondent for United Press International in Washington.
The unanswered question about the conduct of our military campaign may be the most important question. Whatever support America's war on terror can retain in the Muslim world certainly depends upon the answer, and as we've just heard, so does the continued backing of our European allies. That question refers to the number of civilian casualties, and the answer may well be unknowable. The BBC's Simon Ingram is one of a handful of reporters in one of the fields of operations, the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar, and even he does not know.
As we ourselves found this morning, we went to this clinic where we were told that at least 10 people had been killed. However, we weren't shown any of the injured or any of the dead bodies, and we came away with the distinct impression that maybe somebody was being a little bit elaborate with the facts, shall we say.
That's the best answer an honest reporter can provide. And what else have we got? There are the Taliban, whose estimates are broadcast 24/7 to the Arab world on the news outlet Al Jazeera. In recent days, their estimates have swelled to 1,500 civilian dead.
No one can believe the Taliban. Their numbers are preposterous.
John Burnett is one of NPR's reporters based now in Peshawar, Pakistan. He notes that the Taliban offer no evidence for their horrific figure. There were plenty of bodies to count in 1995 when the Taliban waged their civil war in Afghanistan, but now they offer none.
If the numbers were that terrible, the Taliban would show us the bodies because it would be in their best interest to, and we haven't seen those. Until Afghanistan opens up for more reporters to independently confirm these things, it is absolutely going to be a hit-or-miss business.
Mostly, reporters are permitted only on the outskirts of the war zone, in Pakistan, Uzbekistan, or northern Afghanistan, where they interview witnesses with unverifiable accounts of the bombing and independent agencies with their own agendas.
Relief agencies are saying that. The bombing is largely targeted, and there are mistakes, and that's what we're seeing on television. Keep in mind that the aid organizations have a very poor relationship with the Taliban and would like to see them gone.
And then there is the Defense Department. Pentagon spokesman Major James Casella told us that the military planners do their utmost to avoid civilian casualties, but that they are not in the business of counting bodies. Former ABC Pentagon reporter Bob Zelnick, now a professor at Boston University, says there is good reason for that.
I think the military still is sensitive to the black eye it got in Vietnam through its egregious miscounts.
During the Vietnam War, it was in the Pentagon's interest to inflate the number of enemy dead, combatants, not civilians. The ploy had a disastrous and lasting impact on the Pentagon's credibility, and there have been more recent examples of apparent military mendacity.
In Kosovo, when a truckload of civilians was hit, the first impulse of the military was to suggest that the Serbs themselves had blown up the vehicle for purposes of claiming it was hit by an American bomb. And then when the evidence became irrefutable, because reporters got out there and actually saw the bomb fragments, the military reassessed its response and acknowledged that it had been an errant American strike.
Zelnick suggests that if the Pentagon offers no tallies of civilian deaths in the current case, it may be because it has none or no good ones. There are, he says, only a few ways to estimate the death toll of enemy combatants.
Number one, there are some photographic evidence that they take following action. Number two, there are electronic intercepts. If a Taliban commander says we need another 300 soldiers up here to replace the fighters who were killed or incapacitated, and that's intercepted. The third is from prisoners taken in combat, of which there are none or very few that have occurred so far. And that's the relatively more easy figure to come by, the enemy combat casualties. As far as the military knowing the number of civilians it killed, any specific number that they suggest usually lacks credibility.
Ultimately, it may not be the numbers that matter, but rather the pictures of the dead and the dying. We rarely see those pictures on American television, in American newspapers. The Middle Eastern media are awash in gore.
That's all we see, day in and day out, on the front page of the paper, back page of the paper.
NPR's John Burnett.
In the Muslim world, I don't think the numbers make that much difference. I think it is the pictures that people are reacting to. It's the pictures that Al Jazeera are showing night after night of bodies being pulled from rubble and of women with infected compound fractures coming across the border in Quetta, things like this. This is what is gripping people. It's not a numeral 100 killed as U.S. bomb hits hospital.
It's a very difficult problem.
Journalist and historian Philip Knightley.
All I can say is, let's look back on Vietnam. The figures didn't in the end really count. What counted was images, and you had an image of a young girl running down a roadway in Vietnam with her back on fire as a result of a napalm attack. One child. You had General Lowen shooting a suspect VC through the head on camera. One person. It was this accumulation of images rather than figures that made people in the end realize that this war was unsustainable.
This visit with Taliban officials, a first-hand chance to examine previous accounts of civilian deaths.
Last Friday, CNN's Nick Robertson described the devastation of objects, but not people.
Looking around the village, there appears to be a lot of evidence that this was a place occupied by poor people. There is a radio, what's left of it, and the scraps of what appears to be heavy armament. But it is impossible to verify the accounts of how many people died.
Recently, the chairman of CNN, Walter Isaacson, ordered his staff to exercise caution in its use of images of civilian suffering, saying that given the violent legacy of the Taliban, it, quote, seems perverse to focus on the casualties and hardships in Afghanistan. And he added, we must talk about how the Taliban are using civilian shields and how the Taliban have harbored the terrorists responsible for killing close to 5,000 innocent people. How many people? Even in America, the ghastly reckoning defies the numbers game. There have been ongoing independent investigations of the death toll by several newspapers. According to the New York Times, the 5,000 estimated lost at the World Trade Center amounts to 2,405.
Coming up, stories undercovered in the aftermath and the body's ongoing campaign against the media.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, Bernadine Healy resigned, or was, she believed, forced out of her post as president of the American Red Cross. It was the first time that the internal disputes and politics of America's richest charity were aired in almost all media outlets. Readers learned, for instance, that there was an ongoing dispute within the Red Cross over Israel's inclusion in the International Red Cross.
But the question is, why were reporters forced into live shots of the barn door after the horse had already fled? Why didn't they see it coming? Joining me now is Gilbert Gall, a reporter for The Washington Post and two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. He was also a finalist for the Pulitzer in 1994 when he investigated nonprofits for 18 months. Gilbert, welcome to OTM.
Thanks very much.
All right, let me start by asking you this. Yeah, okay. So I'm on the charity beat. That just doesn't sound all that macho, you know what I'm saying?
Right. First of all, there really hasn't been much of a charity beat in the media. Even today, it's rarely covered on any kind of systematic and continuing basis. The coverage tends to be limited to when you have a huge announcement like Bill and Melinda Gates decide they're going to give away several billion dollars and create a foundation. But what we don't do is we don't think of it as being an integral part of the economy, as being something important in our communities. And that's both when the scandals occur, but also for just sort of the continuing good things that happen.
Now, why is that? We're talking about multi-billion dollar organizations in some cases.
Yeah, as best as I've ever been able to figure it out, it just goes back to this uneasy relationship that we've had with charities in the media over time. We tend to have had a lot of overlap where you have publishers and people on the boards of newspapers and TV stations actively participating in charities, and so there's a little bit of reluctance, although nobody would ever admit it, to applying the same level of scrutiny to those organizations simply because of that awkwardness and tension. And I think, you know, there's just in our country the tradition of philanthropy and charity is very strong, and we want to believe that these folks are doing nothing but good deeds, and we don't think to apply the same level of scrutiny that we would to other organizations.
The latest tempest came out of the American Red Cross. Before that, I guess the last huge scandal was about 10 years ago with the United Way.
Right.
One of the things that came out of that was a vastly diminished contribution to United Way agencies all over the country. Do you think that news organizations shy away from this coverage for fear of good, solid reporting actually causing charities to just take in less dough?
I don't think so. If you look at United Way, yeah, donations were down for a year or so, but then they began to creep back up, and I believe they are at least back to that level, if not having exceeded that level. And that tends to be true with most organizations. It's the rare organization where the abuses are so egregious that it actually brings down the organization.
Let me ask you one final thing. By not paying close attention to the charities, ordinarily newspapers, when some large event occurs, have a tendency to get spun. In the case of the American Red Cross, the board sources are trying to spin it one way, namely that Bernardine Healy was an out-of-control, tyrannical manager operating as a free agent within an enormous organization. And then there's her spin, which is that she was the brave, principled protector of Israel. Mm-hmm. Do you think that had news organizations been paying more attention, that the picture would be a lot clearer here?
Without a doubt. It would be a lot clearer.
Were you rolling your eyes reading the coverage going, oh, yeah, they got spun?
I'm not rolling my eyes. I guess I'm reading the stories and thinking this is yet one more example of how we blew it, of how we weren't paying attention or asleep at the switch and should have been paying attention over the years. I mean, Red Cross is a $2.2 billion organization. It's revered within this country. It plays incredibly important roles here and internationally. For those reasons alone, we ought to be covering it more systemically than we do. I guess the other thing is, I mean, I've read the stories, and I felt as if what I was reading was one or another version of the spin. I didn't get the sense I was reading a full, truthful, honest version of events. I'm not seeing that yet in the media coverage.
Well, Gilbert Gall, thank you very much.
Okay.
Gilbert Gall is a member of the Investigations Unit on the national staff of the Washington Post.
Serving the victims of September 11th will be a challenge for charities and a story for the media for years to come. But the story of the minutes immediately after the planes hit the Twin Towers is also important and also undercovered. Thus far, the press has been largely reluctant to question the strategies of the New York Fire Department, but little by little those questions are being asked. On the Media's John Solomon reports.
In a story that is so raw and sensitive, it may be the most raw and sensitive part. The heroic actions and tragic deaths of 343 firemen, as well as other rescue personnel, has been the most enduring media image of that day. Yet strikingly, the press has done little in-depth analytic reporting on what actually happened on the ground and in the buildings on the 11th. In the days afterward, there were some news stories on how cities around the U.S. were rethinking their firefighting strategies, but almost nothing on the specific incident at the Trade Center. The prevailing media narrative seemed to be that the attack and the subsequent building collapses were so unexpected that it couldn't have been planned for nor handled any differently.
We're all New Yorkers. Clearly, New York City is facing the biggest crisis it's ever faced in its history.
Steve Paulus is the general manager of the local cable all-news channel, New York One.
The way that city officials are portraying this story is in a way that will be as positive throughout the country, throughout the world. So, you know, you don't want to be the first guy to step out and start throwing mud at what our leaders are saying.
The first major media organization to directly report on any aspect of the firefighting and rescue strategy was the Wall Street Journal, 6 weeks after the incident. The journal's story focused on why helicopters were not used to rescue people trapped at the top of the Trade Center. It quoted a New York police pilot saying he might have been able to land on the roof as he did after the 1993 bombing. The article also explained that the helicopter rescue had been the subject of interdepartmental squabbling. A fire department spokesman acknowledged that there was no plan in place for dealing with a fire on multiple floors of a skyscraper. Yet despite the provocative issues raised by the journal, the subject came up only briefly at Mayor Giuliani's daily press conference. New York One's Steve Paulus.
It's very unusual for the media to, the entire New York City press corps, to fundamentally stay away from a story, but I can certainly understand why being part of that media.
Charles Jennings, an assistant professor of fire science at New York's John Jay College, understands the very difficult position reporters are in, but he says he is disappointed with the coverage thus far.
What has been surprising to me, to some extent, is the degree to which the media has not asked any real questions in terms of establishing a timeline for what happened when, asking questions as basic as, did the fire department, were they aware of some of the risks in terms of the structure? Was there communication between the Port Authority and the fire department in terms of the stability of the buildings?
To get those questions answered, the press faces a number of logistical challenges. The fire department is still very much under siege. Already shorthanded, it is trying to carry out its normal work in addition to expanded emergency responsibilities. Its officials are attending frequent funerals and memorial services. What's more, fire safety and structural engineering are very complex topics, and many of the eyewitnesses are dead. And with so much else going on, the press is in triage mode. It believes it can get to the rescue story in due time. However, Professor Jennings cautions that time is of the essence.
We're now entering into this post-September 11th world in which we may indeed confront the prospect of firefighters having to attempt rescue in a building that is actively under or has been under terrorist attack. I think there's an urgency to trying to open this question up and get the information out there and to stimulate some public discussion.
Recently, the local press, most notably the New York Daily News, has slowly begun to look at these issues. They are showing a level of restraint not usually a hallmark of the hyper-competitive New York media market. One example was an October 28th Daily News story. It quoted engineering experts who contend that had a structural engineer been on site, the fire department might have been able to predict the tower's quick collapse. That information may have allowed some rescue personnel to evacuate earlier. It was a revelation that might make for an eye-catching tabloid front page. Instead, the story was on page 23, accompanied by the soft-spoken headline, "Learning from Tower's Disaster." Reporter Joe Calderon wrote the story.
It's not the first time that I have written something that I thought was brilliant that didn't get on the front page, but there is a sensitivity still. I think it's probably appropriate.
Calderon says special times call for a special approach.
Did we react differently than some other kind of story? Probably, yeah. I think at the same time, I don't think that the press is like falling down on the job. But, you know, we are humans.
The co-author of the original Wall Street Journal article, Scott Paltrow, concedes it is difficult to focus on these questions when everyone is burying their dead. But he adds that as we seem to be in some danger, and no one knows what is going to happen next, reporters need to set aside their qualms and try to find some answers. For On the Media, this is John Solomon. We'll be right back.
A new front in the war on terrorism has opened in the Midwest. The combatants include a pro wrestler turned Minnesota governor and the press corps that covers him. Citing the ongoing campaign against terrorism and the threat of future attacks, Governor Jesse Ventura has drastically reduced his media availability, restricted access to his public schedule, and hunkered down inside his wood-paneled office at the state capitol, from which he's launched his own war against the media. From Minnesota Public Radio, Michael Koo has more.
Governor Ventura declined to be interviewed for this story. That's no surprise. On his weekly radio program, he recently declared war on local reporters, threatening to make them, quote, run like the Taliban. The following week, while guest hosting another show, the verbal fusillade began.
You don't need nighttime news, and you don't need the daily newspapers. Listen to talk radio. I'll tell you, it's more accurate on there. Well, I'll tell you that.
Ventura has previously blamed reporters for the demise of the short-lived XFL Football League, requested they wear badges labeled Official Jackal, and berated them for sensationalism. The current dispute began during Ventura's trip to the World Trade Center disaster site in early October. The only cameras allowed to accompany the governor to Ground Zero were from ABC's Good Morning America, which paid for the governor's trip to New York. When some Minnesota reporters questioned their lack of access, Ventura's office insisted the exclusion of Minnesota journalists was solely at the discretion of New York Governor George Pataki's office, and they said ABC's payment for the trip is standard practice. Ventura says any suggestion he's selling media access is insulting.
The media gave me heat. The media created that story and tried to make it look like the First Lady and I did something underhanded.
A month later, Ventura still fumes over the episode. Veteran reporters say that level of hostility is unprecedented. Bob Werat covers state government for the Star Tribune, the state's largest newspaper. He's covered six governors since he first came to the Capitol in 1969. He says the reporting has, overall, been legitimate and fair.
We have not a constitutional role, but just a role to try to tell folks what's going on and explain as best we can what it all means. And I don't think he's ever accepted that that is part of our function. Other governors, whether they liked it or not, understood it.
Werat says other elected officials have complained about media coverage, but none has gone to Ventura's lengths to avoid reporters' questions, lengths that include withholding his public schedule from the Capitol Press Corps. Initially, the administration claimed releasing the schedule was a security risk in the new climate of terror, but spokesman John Woodley now acknowledges the governor's frustration with the press played a role.
You know, he has a sense of being besieged, and if the media doesn't know where he's at every second, they can't get to him. He can find some peace.
In recent weeks, the governor has agreed to give advance warning on selected public events. He's still making the rounds on the radio call-in shows, including several appearances on Minnesota Public Radio. He's granted interviews to smaller papers scattered around the state and even held sporadic press conferences. But during a recent Q&A session on Minnesota's tourism industry, Ventura made it clear he would decide what questions were appropriate. One reporter made the mistake of asking if the September 11th attacks had dampened tourism in the land of 10,000 lakes.
We're not here to do typical media negativism, and we feel very good about Minnesota, and so therefore I'm not going to entertain negative questions that deal with negativism.
Spokesman Woodley says despite Ventura's running battle with the media, the governor has been remarkably successful as a policymaker. But Woodley admits press battles don't help anyone.
Would I like to see an end to this, you know, as his press secretary? Absolutely, I would like to. I think it would be very helpful to him.
But Woodley can't say when or if that point will come. Only Ventura can answer that question. If I could ask him, I would. For On the Media, I'm Michael Koo in St. Paul.
Laura Billings is a columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and she decided to take up the governor's call to put down your newspaper and tune into talk radio. Laura, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
So, tell me, was it difficult? You wrote here that you decided to take up Jesse Ventura after consulting with your doctor.
Well, I'm 6 months pregnant, so I'm supposed to be keeping an eye on my blood pressure, so I thought that would be wise to check in, and I do tend to get a little little riled listening to talk radio. I'm kind of the liberal female at the newspaper and make no apologies about it and don't try to hide it, but often my column ends up being dissected on our local talk radio programs.
What isn't being reported in the newspaper that you learned from talk radio?
Well, they just hate the Clintons, of course, and I mean, that's been a big business for them. And so the callers were completely outraged by a story that, and the way I heard it on the radio was that it was Hillary Clinton's driver's chauffeur had hit a New York City police officer and had injured him in such a way that he'd, you know, been 2 weeks or something, and he was still unable to go back to work.
That's funny. That wasn't reported by the Eastern Establishment Press here in New York City.
It wasn't reported anywhere. And I looked all through the NexusLexis database and was unable to locate that.
You did a tally of some of the enlightening things you've heard, and number one on your list?
Okay, the number of times I heard a host or caller blame President Clinton for everything that's happened in the Middle East, the September 11th attacks, Iraq, the downturn in the economy, the rise of Osama bin Laden, and all current woes, 16. And the number of hosts or callers who suggested that not taking Saddam Hussein out when we had the chance is a mistake we may be paying for, 11. And number of times hosts or callers pointed out that George Bush was actually the president in office during the Persian Gulf War when we had the chance, 0. Number of callers who wondered whether CNN could be prosecuted for treason for requesting an interview with Osama bin Laden, 2. Number of hosts who explained that getting an interview is not the same thing as consorting with the enemy, 1. Number of hosts who added, but still, you have to wonder where the media stands sometimes, if they're on our side or not, or another phrase to that effect, 2.
Jesse says that he finds it very enlightening and very less stressful, in his words, to listen to talk radio rather than read the newspaper or watch the evening news.
Yeah, well, you know, complex issues are confusing. They drive up our blood pressure. They make our heads pound in the morning. And
you don't sound less stressed to me, Laura.
I'm not, I guess. I don't think it actually, the experiment didn't work for me. It didn't hold.
I guess the moral of the story here is that talk radio is not less stressful for liberals.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. You know, talk radio and in wrestling, you need an enemy. And the governor has been really genius almost in turning the media, you know, it used to be Hulk Hogan, now it's the media that is his enemy. And I think that's a lesson that he learned and learned really well on talk radio, where there is an enemy and the enemy is me.
Well, not just you. I mean, yeah, right. Also Bill Clinton.
Right. Bill Clinton and me. Yeah. So
Laura Billings, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Laura Billings is a columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press.
Coming up, Pakistan's surprisingly free press and how ideas both grand and goofy spread like viruses on the Internet.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In Pakistan, the press is diverse and divided by language into roughly three camps. The English language press is widely read by the educated elite and is far more influential in political circles than the circulation would suggest. Then there are the Urdu publications, read by hundreds of thousands more. Finally, there are a variety of what are called ethnic publications in languages like Pashto that focus on regional concerns. Professor Akbar Ahmed holds the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington and has written award-winning books on Pakistan and modern Islam. He says that the linguistic divisions in the Pakistani press often reflect political divisions.
By and large, you see, even in this particular crisis, that the English press supports General Musharraf. For instance, the Friday Times published from Lahore a weekly, seen to be a liberal, is very strongly in support of General Musharraf and would support his more pro-Western position and would be arguing that this is the time to finish off or marginalize totally the religious parties. Now, the Urdu press, on the other hand, would take a different position. The Urdu press would reflect a much more mainstream public opinion in Pakistan, and that is reflected, as you see, in the processions that take place in Pakistan, in the district towns and in the smaller cities.
How about the religious parties? Do they have their own publications?
They don't have their own publications, but they use the Urdu press, which means that they often have editors sympathetic to them. They have articles placed in them, and these are then very widely circulated. They also link up Pakistan with the rest of the Muslim world. For instance, the Jung, which is a very popular Urdu paper published in Pakistan, is also published in London.
I think for people in America, it's hard to imagine that a military regime would be regarded as moderate, as General Musharraf's wing of the political spectrum is supposed to be. What is the situation regarding press freedom in Pakistan?
We have seen that the last few years have seen probably the freest press in Pakistan history. And I think one of the reasons is simply that there are just too many papers to try to clamp down on, even if that were possible, even if there was the will to do so. So I think General Musharraf has allowed the press to be as free as possible. Very often they attack him personally. In fact, I would say that there's so much freedom that it veers off into anarchy, and editorials will be saying one thing on one page, and on the next page you may have a writer completely disagreeing with the editorial policy of its own paper.
Elsewhere in the Muslim world, the rumors about September 11th have flown all over the place. We know that it's very commonly believed in Egypt and in other countries that no Jews died on September 11th, that they were all tipped off and escaped the catastrophe. A lot of these rumors fly, and there isn't any mechanism for debunking them in the mainstream press. Have you got any debunkers working in Pakistan?
Yes, you do see the odd debunking going on. For instance, I did read something in the Dawn newspaper, which is an English newspaper in Pakistan, probably the most respectable paper of Pakistan. And I did read an editorial pointing out that these emails are circulating and then refuting this and rejecting this and saying this is absurd and that we Muslims are somehow caught up in this psychological bind where everything is seen in terms of a conspiracy, this conspiracy or that conspiracy.
Last Monday, the Pakistani daily, The Nation, reported that the U.S. was preparing a massive ground attack, and they cited high-level government sources. What sort of paper is The Nation?
The Nation traditionally is a more right paper. It is also linked to the Nawai Waqt, which is an Urdu paper, again, very influential. And both of these are published from Lahore, which is the capital of the Punjab province, which is the most important province of Pakistan, the most populated province, and particularly significant because the majority of the Pakistan army comes from the Punjab. So what is said in The Nation and the Nawai Waqt, its Urdu sister paper, what is said is watched and read by people very carefully because in a sense it reflects the mainstream opinion of Pakistanis towards the right.
And if The Nation is reporting through unnamed sources that the U.S. is preparing a massive ground attack, that will be believed.
Yes, that would be believed. It would not only be believed, people would begin to take action on the basis of these reports. So, for instance, on the Friday prayer in Lahore particularly, where Muslims will gather, you may well have speeches, and someone may even refer to an article like this from The Nation or the Nawai Waqt and quote this as the gospel truth. And that in itself would be enough to agitate or excite people's passions and ideas.
Very well. Professor Ahmed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Professor Akbar Ahmed is a professor of Islamic studies at American University and the author of many prize-winning books on Islam. His latest book is called Islam Today.
CameraPlanet.com was created with the idea of bypassing conventional media organizations and putting video storytelling in the hands of the civilian. In the immediate aftermath of the World Trade Center attack, that founding principle mutated somewhat as the company's own videographers rushed to the scene. Still, within hours, the website found itself at ground zero in the world of Internet democracy, as Camera Planet executive producer Steve Rosenbaum explains.
The news crews were doing their job. They were looking for their live trucks. They were trying to feed breaking news stories. They were trying to make their cell phones work. They had to be reporting instantly. Because our guys were documentary filmmakers, their mission was just stand still, take a deep breath, and make pictures. And so the tape has a quality that's a little bit less frenetic and a little bit more revealing, I think.
All right, then what did you do with it? You had all these hours and hours of tape.
I went home for about 2 hours sleep and woke up at 4 a.m. on what was then Wednesday morning and heard on the radio in my daze that there had been a song that a band had posted on the internet and that this song was being given away free. And it was a song by a band I'd never heard of. It's a band called Live. And the song was called Overcome. And there I was sitting in the office listening to the song and watching these pictures. And I was just, it was the first time it really hit me that the only right word for what I was seeing was overcome. I mean, I wasn't angry and I wasn't scared and I wasn't in shock. I was just overcome. Now we had this music and these images, and because I've never made a music video before, I wasn't entirely sure what it is you do once you make one. But there was a guy I had met, and he was relatively new as the head of programming at VH1. And so I made one phone call and said to him, "Hey, I have this video. Do you want to see it?" And he said, "Yeah, send it over. And about an hour later, he called me and said, "Turn your TV on. It's on." The next morning, the phone rings, and it's the manager of the band, and he says, "Are you the guy that made a music video out of our song?" And I went, "Oh, here it comes, lawsuit, you know, license fees, sync rights, royalty," because I knew better. So I kind of held my breath, and I said, "Yeah, that's me." And he said, "Well, we just want to say thank you. It's beautiful, and we really appreciate it."
So VH1 runs it, so that's a lot of distribution right there.
Right.
But you also put it up on its site, and it showed up elsewhere. Just how far did it go, and how fast did it get there?
The minute VH1 played it, it was like lightning hit our website. In fact, that first weekend, we knocked out our parallel servers and ended up spending the better part of Monday putting up 4 servers at our host so that we could just manage the traffic, 30,000, 40,000 views in an hour. And the discussion boards just lit up in this way that was really very exciting and made me think that we were contributing something. The other thing that happened was we got an email from a woman who said, "I just watched this amazing video on VH1, and I'm writing you because my husband's in the video, and I haven't seen him in 2 days. He's still at the site, and seeing him on TV makes me know that he's alive."
Within, say, 7 days of September 11th, do you have any idea how many people around the world saw this video?
We know it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands. I mean, we had 600,000 video views on our site, so it may crest over 1 million. People would send me emails and say, "Do you know you're on Video Pimp?" And we'd go to Video Pimp, and there would be the Overcome video with the VH1 bug in the right-hand corner. And you'd say, "Well, okay, someone recorded it off VH1 on a VHS tape and then encoded it and then uploaded it to their site. And Video Pimp was sharing that file." So all of a sudden, the Video Pimp encoded version was appearing in the Netherlands and in Brussels. And we were getting emails from all over the world saying, "Love your video. How can I get a copy?"
Now, Steve, when Camera Planet was founded, your notion was, if I understand it right, to give an opportunity to non-professional journalists to circumvent big media organizations and their sensibilities, give them an opportunity to do storytelling of their own, unfettered by the conventional wisdom. Lo and behold, here's Camera Planet's biggest hit, produced by professional documentarians, broadcast first by VH1, a major cable network, atop a song that was produced by a double platinum big-time rock band. Any change of heart about the mission of Camera Planet?
I think the answer is yes, there's certainly a role for high-quality, professional, serious, smart storytelling, but there's also as exciting a role for individuals with cameras, and I don't think that they're mutually exclusive.
Steve Rosenbaum is the founder and executive producer of Broadcast News Networks and CameraPlanet.com. It's happened again and again over the harrowing past few weeks. Someone sorts through the mail and encounters a terrorism-inspired surprise. The moment the item is opened, the air fills with strains of something extraordinarily virulent.
George Bush said that revenge come.
Payback come and we drop the bomb.
Load them bombs till the morning come.
Airplane come and we drop the bomb.
Come, Mr. Taliban, turn over Bin Laden.
Colin Powell.
Harry Belafonte, our deepest apologies. What you have just heard, very likely not for the first time, is a parody of the Banana Boat song, in which terrorist evil gets its comeuppance. It was the brainchild 3 weeks ago of the morning drive team at KOMP-FM, Las Vegas.
We were all standing around and we said, you know, what's the best way to make light of this at all?
Sweet Al Miller is co-host of the Rock and Roll Morning Show, where the typical fare is mother-to-be bikini contests, goofy characters saying vulgar things, and the usual zany drive-by shenanigans.
We're goofing around, just shooting ideas around, and then Andy said, "Hey, Mr. Taliban," and that was our buzzword for the to use in the Banana Boat song.
Sweet Al and the gang recorded the parody in one day and put it on the next morning show, but they also posted it on the KOMP website. Soon the site was getting hundreds of downloads. Within a few days, it was getting thousands of downloads, crossing the world and back from Germany to Thailand to every town USA, strictly by word of mouth. Among those amused was Mark Corey, CEO of Oscar Entertainment in Brisbane, Australia, a company that does flash animation for the Internet.
I thought it was excellent that it could be improved with some animation. And we wanted to do something, and everyone was affected by what happened in New York, and we wanted to do something to, you know, lighten the load, so we decided to animate that song, and it just took off from there.
Quickly, Oscar performed its video magic, with primitive cutout figures of George W. Bush and Secretary of State Colin Powell, who were depicted playing the bongos and dropping bombs on Osama bin Laden. A triumph of subtlety it was not, but it impressed Oscar's biggest client, E-Universe, whose 10 websites are filled with emailable animated gags. When E-Universe added the animated version of KOMP's song to its madblast.com site, the epistolary response was exponential. In the past week alone, the Kick Osama's Butt song has been downloaded more than 10 million times. Testament, says E-Universe President Brett Brewer, to the viral quality of email.
I would view this and I would say, wow, you know, my sister and my mom would love to see this piece. You can instantly share something that affects you with four or five other people. And then those four or five other people, obviously, if it touches them, can share that with more. So it just is a really powerful distribution vehicle for sharing anything that has a positive effect or anything that touches somebody.
Or makes them laugh so hard, gross stuff comes shooting out of their nose. The significance of the phenomenon, however, is more than just a global morning zoo. The reason to take note is because the Kick Osama Butt song is a vivid example of the Internet's long hypothesized ability to serve or disserve information democracy. Writer Howard Rheingold, author of The Virtual Community, believes that whoever harnesses this sort of Internet virology can influence political conversation worldwide.
If the quality of information improves and people begin educating each other as well as sending around jokes and rumors, then I think that that will improve democracy.
The key, Rheingold says, is social network analysis, understanding and reaching those who are hubs or nodes of several discrete personal email chains.
On the Internet, the people who propagate a lot of information are not necessarily opinion leaders by the traditional definition. They are people who, for whatever reason, have access to social networks of folks who pay attention to what they send them and resend what they receive from those people to others.
Nobody is burning the midnight oil trying to divine the nodes in the propagation of bongo-playing bomb droppers, because why bother? But if we have learned anything in the past month, it's that what we find in the mail is not always so benign. It may be quite instructive to find the nodes for malicious internet rumors, such as the one about no Jews being among the dead at the World Trade Center, another vivid recent example of internet virology.
I think that a skilled propagandist could take advantage of the internet by finding out who are the nodes in social networks and to target a communication at those people.
Luckily for me, my social network propagator wasn't an evil, libel-spewing propagandist. It was Terrence, a computer dude at a trade magazine company. Terrence has no sinister desire to manipulate worldwide opinion. He just likes to, you know, goof off at work.
The Banana Boat song is just one of many song parodies recorded in the pursuit of some humor in these nervous times. But you may not have heard them if you're the type who's never bothered to program your radio presets with anything but NPR. So it may shock you to learn that Comedy Central's Daily Show recently revealed that NPR itself took a stab at song parody to the tune of the pop hit Let's Hear It for the Boy.
Our ongoing war with the Taliban has produced some troubling alliances. For instance, our relationship with Saudi Arabia is becoming strained as more information about those involved in September 11 come to light. Yeah, the Saudis have traditionally been a tentative ally, given their role in producing oil for the U.S. Now, with tensions rising in the Middle East, the U.S. is pushing the limits of its friendship with the Saudis as that country seeks to maintain its position in the Islamic world. Yeah, the U.S. is pushing the limits of its friendship with the Saudis as that country seeks to maintain its position in the Islamic world. Yeah.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Scott Strickland, Dylan Keefe, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Michael Cavanaugh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink. Drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.